international detective dragons from outer space.
Hello, and welcome or welcome back to International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. I'm Adam Five, and thank you for downloading and listening to episode 25, the second of three parts that all deal with these questions. Are human beings a part of nature? And if we have a role to play in the evolution of life on Earth, are we playing that role well, or have we set fire to the stage? A new member welcome to the Frapper Map coming up, along with feedback. Listener emails on this topic from Derek, Mick Bradley, Sarah, and Kurt the Camera Guy will take the helm for this episode and light the way. If important questions and complex subjects are food, this is a 12-course meal, and the first course comes your way right after this.
But you can press it right back on again. It's just part of the action with the world's only boxing robots, the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Marks. Takes two managers to handle the fighters and lots of skill to win. With these control levers, you can keep your fighters in motion to duck punches. When you press this plunger, he throws a right uppercut. Press the other plunger and there's a left jab. Lots of exciting action and fun for everyone when the world's only boxing robots battle it out.
The Blue Bomber's looking for an opening. And there it is. That's the end of round two.
Just push the flying head back and you're ready for round three.
Boy, this is the greatest.
You bet. The world's only boxing robots. Get the Rock'em Sock'em Robots by Mark.
International Detective Dragons from Outer Space Agency, how can I help you?
This is going to be very difficult.
Not at all. I have here a reversible unilateral bamboo high-fidelity boot-pointed needle made especially for this purpose.
Hello. All right, super. Let's get started. A quick point of information before getting underway. Two audio mini-dramas have been done for International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. One by the Norwegian Viking, Mr. T, which was in the first of the two MMO episodes. That would be number 16. And that was the adventure of his character in the Burning Steps of Azeroth. The other we had the pleasure to listen to in the last podcast, number 24. And that was done by Sam Chupp of the Bears Grove podcast. And both those brilliant pieces of audio are downloadable by themselves if you look to their links in the Kurkatingatangatungs. I made them much smaller and easier to download than the entire episodes that they were played in. I wanted to make them more available as their own files, easy to acquire, easy to share. And if you haven't heard them yet, please give them a listen. They're very skillfully produced and very entertaining. And I thank you gentlemen both very much once again. Next, a welcome and a thank you to Dire Wolf, who has added his pin to the IDD FOS Frapper Map. You will be very happy to note, Dire Wolf, that this week's virtual snack food menu, for all of us grand poobahs on the stratospheric veranda, is a tray each, a full tray for each of us, of every known variety of the world's best chocolates. Oh, yes. And that followed by raspberry, lemon, and cantaloupe-flavored frozen sherbet. The beverage is... oh, damn, the beverage is nothing but cold tonic water. I didn't see anything else. Well, that's a jip, but it will have to serve. Dire Wolf places his pin down in Northwood, North Dakota, and when he joined us, he shouted to us all, "Fantastic! I must say that my muffins and breads come out so much fluffier after listening to your show." Glad to hear it. I'll always be proud to be counted among the baker's yeasts of podcasts. Good deal. You know, I'd like to make mention of something else here, and that is, in the last episode, I pointed out the individuals that have written to IDDFOS, and I read off their names. But in listening to it afterwards, I thought, you know, this might be doing a disservice to the Frapper Map members. I don't want to offer you guys a slight. That was not the intention at all. You folks count, too. So, who's on the IDD FOS Frapper Map? Listen to this. We have Digger Story in Orlando, Florida. Digger Story, the podcast for peace. We've got the very talented and insightful Mr. T from Oslo, Norway. We have Mick Bradley, proprietor of the House of the Harping Monkey and a producer, co-host of the Roundtable and Misfit Brew. He's in Louisville, Kentucky. We've got the Linux Cowboy from Front Royal, Virginia. Jim from Youngstown, Ohio. Sarah, a producer, co-host of Does My Geek Look Big in This? All the way over there in Reading, England. We've got Derek from Canyon, Texas, also known as Agent Desi Liu of the Dragon's Landing Secret Service. We've got Nia Skywalk from Tinley Park, Illinois. We've got Jen from Redmond, Washington. Sean Jay, host of the Shakespeare Cast from Antioch, California. We've also got Mark Kinney, a co-host of All Games Considered. He also from Louisville, Kentucky. We've got C.E. Sales from New Jersey, the author of Hosting the Casimir. And we've got Nev, a producer, co-host of Does My Geek Look Big in This? Also right over there in Reading, England, of course, with Sarah. Smartest One, also known as Daniel O from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. We have the famous and enviable Jim in Buffalo. We've got Design Zombie from Oklahoma City. Sam Bear from Decatur, Georgia. Kurt, also known as Camera Guy from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And, of course, as we just learned, Direwolf from Northwood, North Dakota. All these fine people have taken turns making my day brighter by placing a pin on that map. Now, if you'd be kind enough to do the same, for reasons that are unknown even to me, it would be cause for further grand musical celebrations.
At the time I was asleep in my electrified elephant hammock, when through the pigeonhole flew a carrier pigeon. There was something strapped to its leg. It was a postman.
A letter for you?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hurriedly I tore open the letter. Inside was an envelope with a message that said...
Next, an email from Sarah of Does My Geek Look Big in This? I almost thought this week we weren't going to get one. Please, don't let up on notes to IDDFOS, Sarah. Aside from the fact that they're fun and interesting to read, your emails have become a good luck omen that always put a smile on the show. Also, Nev, if you're listening at the moment, thank you. I had never heard the concept of murder holes in castles being used for water. I, too, was guilty for the longest time of buying into that whole boiling oil thing. And now I know better. Anyone listening that has no idea what I was just talking about, go to www.doesmygeek.com and find out what Nev and Sarah have been up to lately. But, sorry, listen, Sarah writes. Subject, Douglas Adams. Thanks for another enjoyable morning of IDDFOS in our house. After much internet hunting, I found the whole Douglas Adams quote referred to in my last email. Of course, I also found many other excellent quotes that have squirreled their way into this mail, too. Have you ever read Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Most of these quotes come from there, and it's an excellent book. I remember hearing that some scientists believe that our increased brain size is an evolutionary step prompted by humans standing upright. We stood up, we started using our hands as tools. We started making tools. Our brains got bigger to help us make better tools. Hence, standing up was probably our downfall. That's an interesting point, as another view regarding the whole physical attributes, mental improvement, cause and effect seesaw regarding the evolution of intelligence. And speaking of downfall, or rather the fall of man, you made me remember, with that observation, one of the theories that Carl Sagan wrote about in Dragons of Eden. He stated one of the possible reasons for the punishment to Eve in that whole Garden of Eden ejection story, the punishment of pain in childbirth, was that the increased intelligence went tandem with an increased infant cranial size, which would equal a more dangerous and painful birth process. So apparently when we had tinier heads, we were enjoying Eden, but when we wised up, everything went to sh**. Oh, excuse me. Okay, on to Douglas Adams' quotes that Sarah sent in to continue with the letter.
Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place, and some said that even the trees had been a bad move, and that no one should ever have left the oceans. In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and has been widely regarded as a bad move. Man had always assumed that he was more intelligent than dolphins because he had achieved so much. The wheel, New York, wars, and so on. Whilst all the dolphins had ever done was muck about in the water having a good time. But conversely, the dolphins believed themselves to be more intelligent than man, for precisely the same reasons. And a warning for IDDFOS. There is a theory which states that if ever anyone discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarrely inexplicable. Best of days, Sarah.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Douglas Adams is something of a geek cult hero, I believe. All those quotes fit this particular subject quite well, and I hope they'll serve to lighten the intense gravity generated by this topic. As for reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, well, in 1981, when the paperback was released in the United States, I was working in retail in a bookstore chain called B. Dalton's, and of course I got a copy immediately. Now, normally I used to catch a bus to get home from work, but occasionally, either because I didn't feel like riding on the bus or because I was just out of money, occasionally I'd just walk. So on the day that I got Hitchhiker's Guide, I started reading it and began walking home. Now I'm going to put a map in the Gurukatingatungatungs displaying the distance. It was between Wayne, New Jersey and Montclair, 7 miles, straight line from Wayne to Montclair where I was living off campus. And it was considerably longer than 7 miles since I couldn't travel in a straight line. But I had the most fun read I had ever had in my life reading that novel on the way home while risking my life like an idiot, stepping off of curbs, tripping over crappy pavement, bumping into trees. I could have won a Darwin Award for that exhibition, but I just enjoyed the hell out of it. But I was only 21 then. I'm so much smarter now. But thank you. Thank you very much indeed. Excellent quotes, and fits right into this subject matter. Next up, an email from Kurt, the camera guy, in a response to a few more points and questions from recent podcasts.
Subject, explanation of God. Hi, Adam 5. While the subject line of my email has a rather lofty sound to it, the body of the note will be far more mundane. I got to listen to the beginning of the show last night before I headed off to bed.
That would be the ginormous hour and a half show number 24. Fun, but a bit long.
Thanks for the mention of my website, by the way.
Most welcome.
And you were wondering about the origin of my spelling of God. I picked this up from a friend of Mrs. Camera Guy. He happens to be Jewish and explained to my wife that, by tradition, Jews don't spell out the name of God on anything that could be thrown away out of respect for the deity. Instead, they leave out the O and replace it with a dash in normal writings. So the intent is understood by most people just as you did on the podcast. I have a great deal of animus towards this individual, for reasons that have nothing to do with religion. So this is not imitation as flattery, but it did make sense to me and has stuck with me. So in all correspondence and web posts, since many people print them out and later throw them away, I've taken to the habit of spelling out the deity I happen to believe in as capital G-D, though I have no problem referring to other gods, like from Greek myth or an RPG with full spelling. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it covers it completely. And I'm familiar with the Jewish tradition or taboo against speaking the name of God, but I'm glad to get further enlightenment on the written side of it. And it puts me in mind of the recent Terry Pratchett novel, Thud, in which deep down conservative and traditional dwarves, as a culture, have a severe problem with anything being written and then destroyed or thrown away. There's some fascinating cultural parallels there. It's worth a read. Adam, have you read anything other than Pratchett? Well, yes, but we don't have that kind of time tonight. Besides, I haven't finished Kurt's letter. He continues.
Oh, something I forgot to mention in my last email. I am one of the people who listened to your nightmare mini-drama and was too clever by half. I honestly expected the candy bit. And, yes, I did physically raise my hand when I was caught. Also, from that show, to answer one of your questions, the only recurring theme I have in my dreams is the ability to fly, though I've never bothered to look up what that's supposed to mean. Well, I've got to get down the road. I'll be listening to the rest of the show as I drive through Minnesota today. Keep up the great work, Camera Guy. Thank you once again, Camera Guy. No need to feel caught. That lifesaver bit was a cheap trick, and I knew it. And it's just that's just what I would have expected, too, given the corny nature of the rest of all that nightmare audio. And that throw me a lifesaver bit actually can't be credited to the Goon Show. I saw that first in the Marx Brothers film, Horse Feathers. I don't know when the lifesavers were first trademarked, but I'm guessing Groucho was the first on that one. Flying in your dreams. All I've ever heard about that as a symbolic indicator is that you have a good self-image, probably a confident demeanor, and you are a well-balanced individual. Driving through Minnesota now, holy cow. Oregon, California, Minnesota, you've got a podcast listening kind of job. So thank you very much for that email. Now there's another email from the Camera Guy waiting in the wings, and it goes into some details, questions, and analysis of our current topic, so it will be read among those in the main body of the show. And when we get into that, I'm going to return to the letter sent by Derek from Texas and give it the final due attention I didn't have time for in the last show. But first, let's just take a quick break. Back in a bit.
Say, kids, what is it up in the sky? Is it a bird? Is it a plane? No, it's Superman. Yes, sir, kids, a real flying Superman that can be yours. Looks just like Superman himself. He's made of tough blue plastic and has a bright red cape that fits on his shoulders. With your flying Superman, you get a powerful launcher to send him sky high, zooming through space just like Superman does in his adventures. Now, you'll want to be one of the first to have your own flying Superman, so listen carefully, because here's all you do to get yours. Send one box top from Kellogg's Corn Flakes and just 10 cents. That's one box top and just 10 cents to Flying Superman, Box 330, Battle Creek, Michigan. Or use the handy order blank right on the Kellogg's Corn Flakes package. Get your Flying Superman from Kellogg's now.
Now, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to reread that last point, point number three, from Agent Desilu's long-suffering email that's been shunted and pulled apart and delayed and all that. Derek, you had to go and recommend that book, didn't you? Look at what you started. Number three. In Ishmael, something is mentioned that I hope you cover at some point. People in every culture view themselves as the pinnacle of creation. Man was made to rule this planet, and the planet was specifically designed to be ruled by him. This is part of all creation myths. The basic outline of those is intelligent force appears in the cosmos, force makes the world, world grows, man is born. The end of every creation myth is there. Thus, it could be said that humans view themselves as the end of the natural evolution cycle. We are the end result. There are several problems with that, most notably the notion that if humans were to die out this very moment, the world would keep on turning and eventually return to an unblemished state. This point gets into topics of religion and personal scientific consideration, but largely it's still a story told by cultures at large, except believers' cultures. But that's in the book.
Yes, the book. I want to limb out a freeze-dried synopsis of that book right now, before we go any further. I mentioned two episodes ago that it frustrated and annoyed me, and I'm going to list the key points that Daniel Quinn eventually got to with it. And let me preface this by saying, Derek, I congratulate you on steering me towards one of the few books I've read in my life that caused me to actively dislike the main character in it and take great offense to the ideas. I don't have a really good reason for that emotional response either. So if you hear any vitriol or angst in any of this, please know that it isn't directed toward you in any way. How can it be? You set a topic in motion for this podcast that's warranted 3 very rich episodes. So bear with my bitterness and know that it's directed at the gorilla, not you, my friend. Now, first of all, Ishmael, it's been called a novel. It is not a novel. It uses the framework of a story as a vehicle for putting forth philosophical ideas and observations. The story is thus, it's a modern man of civilization, concerned with the overall angst of humanity and the terrifying pace at which we're moving, and he wants a teacher. He wants a teacher to explain to him how things got the way they are. And he finds one, but it turns out to be a telepathic gorilla. A lowland silverback gorilla named Ishmael. That's pretty much the story in a nutshell. Over a course of series of meetings with this gorilla, he's led, and therefore we as the readers are led, to pull the ideas out of this teacher like pebbles out of a burning campfire. This was one of the most frustrating aspects of the book for me. I don't know how it's going to be for you, but it drove me out of my mind. As a teacher, this ape, in order to serve the framework of the story, he was playing the role of teacher, a telepathic ape. He was exercising all of the worst traits I ever experienced from anyone at the front of a classroom. Anyone that's playing the role of teacher, purporting to be leading the student toward discovering the answers for himself or herself, that practice of asking innumerable questions like, well, what do you think this means? And who can tell me where this would lead to? But feeding tiny little piecemeal obscure clues and running roughshod over this stupid game of can you guess what my conclusions are? It was like each concept that Queen was trying to get across through this gorilla was like a 500-piece puzzle. And Ishmael, the gorilla, would give the protagonist 30 of the pieces. And then he'd ask for the complete picture. What does it look like? And when no answer from the pupil was forthcoming, the inevitable chastisement was, think. Think harder. I hate that. But I got past it. I got beyond it and actually managed somehow to hold on to whatever points, most of the major points anyway, that Quinn was trying to get across. So what were those concepts? In a nutshell, and not necessarily in the order that they appear in between the pages. Here's one of them. Humanity is perfectly well designed to live in the natural world and was evolved to do so. The social and political failures that we suffer and the disasters and corruption and war, they are not an inherent flaw in people, but the result of the fabrication of civilization. Civilization is a relatively new phenomenon in human history, and it broke away from what was working perfectly fine for hundreds of thousands of years. A subset of that concept is that laws and profits and systems of government are patches and quick fixes to a wrong choice as a species. Okay, another key topic, another high point. The biblical story of the fall is that humanity ate the forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. From Ishmael's point of view, that knowledge was supposed to be the province of the gods, and that knowledge consisted of what lives and what dies here on earth. When human beings began growing a surplus of food and developed civilization, that was the fall of man. That was the point at which humanity, and as it's gotten across in this book, the way it appears to me anyway, that was the point where apparently humanity takes on the prideful role of Lucifer ruling on earth, rather than submitting to the will of the gods or to nature or whatever it is the universe has in store for him, and decides for himself what lives and what dies. More practically, from my point of view, deciding that he himself just didn't particularly feel like dying that year. Sorry. Another point further. The biblical story of Cain and Abel was a parable written by the Levers, the Lever culture, to indicate how wrong and evil the takers were. It was the agricultural offering to God that was rejected, not the lamb of the nomadic tribal culture. And so it was an indication by the leavers, the hunter-gatherers, that the agriculturalists and their new civilization, deciding that they shall live and whatever doesn't serve the growth of civilization and power will die, it was an indication that they all are Cain, the murderer of man. Another concept, and we're getting very close to the end here. The concept that our current-day civilization as a whole can be compared to one of those early comical flying machine contraptions when we first began trying to learn how to fly. Ishmael compares it to a hopeless gizmo that's been pushed off a cliff, and it will crash because it cannot defy the laws of aerodynamics. Everything seems great at the moment if you're on board the craft, i.e., participating in civilization, because we're in mid-fall. He uses that analogy because just as there are laws of aerodynamics, there is also a law of nature. Unchecked growth by any organism will result in the extinction of that organism. Second to last for what I'm going to cover, the lever cultures. The tribes of hunter-gatherers living in harmony with nature had no prophets because they didn't need anyone to tell them what was right from wrong or how to behave. We didn't get into conflicting ideologies or holy wars until, again, we invented civilization. Now, there are a few more ideas sprinkled in and gotten across by this gorilla as he placidly eats the leaves off of some branch. Leaves, by the way, that humans can't digest. But those are the high points. And finally, as pointed out in point 3 of Derek's letter, the human viewpoint, the shared commonality of myth across all cultures is that we view ourselves as the end result of creation, the final accomplishment of the earth and the pinnacle of creation. The impression very strongly given by this book, by what through the mouthpiece of this gorilla Quinn is saying, the impression given is that this was a ludicrously stupid, not just prideful, but stupid, erroneous conclusion to reach, that we are the end of the myth story, that our myths end with man being created, that this was the height of comical ignorance and stupidity. That is the impression that I got, the impression coming from a gorilla saying to a human being, who do you think you are? And you know what? That pisses me off. That pisses me off. Now, I mean, you can narrow down the view of human beings today. All you have to do is drive on the roads of New Jersey, and you'll be in full agreement with the Adams quote that Sarah sent in, that we never should have left the trees. And the idea that we're the purpose and the end result of creation, that most of the time, if you look really closely at any individual or small group of individuals, it just has to make you laugh. It made Mark Twain laugh like mad. You know, there's a familiar old maxim that man is the noblest work of God. Well, now, who found that out? And I pointed out myself on a larger scale. We had a comet crash into Jupiter. We had a comet crash into Jupiter, and what were the headlines filled with? The O.J. Simpson trial. And we've had towns set on fire over the outcomes of soccer matches. You know, you could list one example after another. From one point of view, on a certain scale, we'd all have to side with the gorilla on this one. It's ludicrous and the height of stupidity to write our myths as if we're the end result of evolution. But it continues to piss me off. The way it's put across in this book pisses me off, because at the time all those myths were written, and at this very moment, we are. Excuse me, Ishmael, but is that prideful? Is that arrogant? Is that yet another example of human hubris? Maybe so. Maybe so. Pride cometh before a fall? All right, I can accept that. But I want to know, you big, smug, literary ape, what else were we supposed to do? What else were we supposed to write? What species is holding the gold medal right now for active curiosity, intellectual contemplation, and study of the universe that spawned it, and the only observable earthbound creatures that have been to the moon and back several times? I mean, when you step back and you look at the violent, risky, high-speed, bloody track we've been running this race on, generation after generation in our woefully short little lives, what the amount of brilliance and horror, beauty and destruction over the 6 millennia since those first awful human criminals dared to begin plowing up the soil, I think we've earned the right to be just a little bit proud. I feel that way anyway. Now, I know it seems popular and very deep and intellectual to look at humanity as the Earth's bad cold, and I felt that way myself on many occasions, but I'm sorry. For not getting a signpost, let alone a map, as camera guy said, the Earth didn't come with instructions. I think we did some pretty impressive traveling to get where we are now. We may not like everything about it, we may not enjoy everything about it, or be enamored of everything we've ever done, but we got here to 2006, and I can send this bitter, prideful message out to lots of people by way of electrified dirt that's been taught to repeat it. Of course our myths end with us as the end product. Of course they do. It's hardly going to conclude with,
"And then the gods saw that humanity sucked and brought forth the age of the hissing cockroach."
And there's a moment in the Star Trek whale movie when an interstellar probe starts boiling the oceans with that indecipherable message. I love the line. I love this line. "Only human arrogance would assume the message is meant for man." Well, excuse me. I'm so sorry. Let's just stand back and ask politely, excuse me, all other species here on Earth, indicating a language and technology capable of communicating with interstellar probes, please slither, crawl, or hop forward. This call may be for you. Give me a break. Ishmael, you pissed me off just like you said you would. Derek, you've supercharged 3 episodes of IDDFOS. Thank you. We're going to take a break now, and on the opposite side of the break, we will get into the email from Camera Guy. Back in a bit.
Meet Mr. Clean, Procter & Gamble's new all-purpose liquid cleaner.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute.
Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it.
Floors, doors, walls, halls, white sidewall, tires, and old golf balls.
Sinks, stoves, bathtubs he'll do. He'll even help clean laundry too.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute.
Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it. Can he clean a kitchen sink?
Quicker than a wink.
Can he clean a window sash?
Faster than a flash.
Can he clean a dirty mirror?
He'll make it bright and clearer.
Can he clean a diamond ring?
Mr. Clean cleans anything.
Mr. Clean gets rid of dirt and grime and grease in just a minute.
Mr. Clean will clean your whole house and everything that's in it. Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean, Mr. Clean.
And so, in bearing with this topic and in reply directly to it, this again from Kurt the Camera Guy. He writes,
"Hi, Adam 5. I've been giving your topic the consideration it deserves, and to be quite frank with you, I'm not sure where to start with this email. However, I'll give my best shot to making this email more coherent than it appears in my head. Ah, the miracle of editing. I have 2 basic thoughts on the topic, which I will flesh out as we go along. Where did humanity take a wrong turn? Quite frankly, I think it was in the design stage. Whether you believe we were designed as a single unit by God, or that nature evolved us by keeping our best survival traits and discarding the rest, human beings are designed to best work in crisis situations. Our adaptability, curiosity, problem-solving skills, the fact that we are omnivorous, the ability to work in groups, and that some of them would lead those groups in a single purpose, and our capacity for great violence all speak to an animal that can deal with and survive in extreme adverse conditions. However, with the advent of agriculture, humans have fewer crises to deal with. And as civilization has progressed, humans have even fewer day-to-day crises, not of its own making. However, the basic traits are still there. In computer terms, we have a firmware problem. We have tried to rein in the worst of them over the millennia with religion, social mores, and the rule of law, but they still manifest themselves in many forms. These varied traits, however, have allowed us to survive and thrive to the point at which we can have this conversation in the first place. If we were the type of creatures that would work best in the world we have now, we would never have made it to that world in the first place.
I think what you just stated there is something that I've gone along with and pretty much been saying myself for the past couple of, for any time during the podcast that I've mentioned this, and that is that if we were designed perfectly to fit within the natural ecosystem, we would not have evolved to the state we're in now in terms of technology, complexity, and the fact that we're having this conversation. We would not have created the human world as we know it if we were perfectly suited to live in the one we started in. Correct me if I'm wrong there. To continue.
The trait I think is most destructive in our non-crisis world is the need to have power over others. This served an important function while we were hunter-gatherers, since bringing down large game with primitive weapons required a coordinated effort. Thus, it was an essential tool for early humans to have a percentage of the tribe be strong at it. Today, it manifests itself from the personal level of some guy yelling at his wife if she doesn't have dinner ready when he gets home, to the macro level of a group of people who want everyone in the world to worship a deity in their manner or they will kill you. I'm sure there's further I could go with this thought, but I'll leave it there for now. Is humanity a part of nature, and is he harming the planet? As I've stated before, I think humans are a part of nature. And as a part of nature, we have the same drives as other animals do. We just happen to have the intelligence to think about them and wonder if we're doing the right thing. We have a drive to procreate. Boy, do some of us have a drive to procreate. Just like all the other species on the planet, as a species, humans have been extremely successful in that mission. We're the only animals that are in every climate on the planet and thrive in all of them. Admittedly, we do take resources from the planet to accomplish this. However, as our civilization matures, we continue, if I can borrow a phrase from pop science, to reduce our environmental footprint. We are also becoming better stewards of the planet we are a part of, if nothing else, out of sheer self-preservation.
I've got to stop there, Kurt, because I really want to believe that. At present, I don't. At present, I don't think that's the case. I want to believe that, and I'd appreciate any kind of examples you can give me. I mean, I know they're out there, but overall, my impression or my sense is that we're actually not doing that. We're not actually reducing our environmental footprint, nor becoming better stewards. But if you can fill me in on what leads to that conclusion, the specific examples, I'd really appreciate it. I'd like to think that. I want to believe that. Sorry, to continue.
We're not leavers yet. But I can see a future that, if we were allowed to continue our admittedly stumbling pace, we could at least be able to break even when it comes to the balance of resources we use and those we restore to the planet.
Man, I sure hope so. There's plenty of extreme points of view that think otherwise, but like most extreme points of view, I try to take them with a grain of salt. You get one extreme into the other, you get the rosy, perfect future view, and you get the dire post-apocalyptic, there's going to be barely enough humans alive left to continue the species point of view. And I think somewhere in the middle, will find the truth, but I keep going back to that springboard of my own ignorance. Quiet, Adam. Read the rest of the letter, please.
The planet and our place on it did not come with instructions. We, collectively, have been fumbling our way through the dark for 2 or 3 million years, making mistakes and enduring growing pains, and have only made it to the tail end of the adolescence as an intelligent species. We are starting to clean up our own messes, trying to plan ahead for our later years, and are starting to seriously consider moving out to other planets. While we have made many wrong turns over our time here, I believe that we have been heading generally in the right direction, despite our instinct to even more destructive behavior. We are a work in progress, and that progress will be our legacy, whether we are here to see it or not. Thanks for the great show, Camera Guy.
Once again, I've got to say, the feedback that I've gotten, in terms of quality, you know, I whined a bit in the last show about quantity, but in terms of quality, from everyone I've heard from, the intelligence and the eloquence and the carefully considered ideas gotten across in the emails that I've gotten back is just phenomenal. We're going to find out through Mick Bradley's letter that there is human myth that at least considers the possibility that ages of humanity can come to an end as new ones begin. Back in a bit.
Creepy crawlers, creepy crawlers, creepy crawlers.
Now, you can make all kinds of lovely things like these with Mattel's wonderful Thing Maker. It makes creepy crawlers, spiders, lizards, snakes, dragonflies. Make them yourself with this nice plastic goop. Choose a mold, pour in the goop, heat it, and presto change-o! You've got bugs. Squiggly, squirchy bugs. They feel so soft and natural. You get 4 different colors of goop and special paints. Make charming lizard pins or spider rings. You can collect them or spread them around. After all, they are fun for the entire family. Get Mattel's new Thing Maker with creepy crawlers. You can tell it's Mattel. It's swell.
Okay, and back we are. I'm going to attempt to take off my opinionation hat and stow it away in the cupboard as we move on to this email from Mick Bradley of the House of the Harping Monkey and the Round Table and Misfit Brew, and just a discoverer of an extraordinary example of serendipity, synchronicity, as he refers to it, synergy, involving this topic in general, role-playing games, and the fact that we've come full circle in terms of finding a source of information. How about I shut up now and read the letter? Topic.
Subject line. The big stuff. Thoughts on where we went wrong. Annam, hi, it's Mick. I was thinking of sending this via an audio comment, but I changed my mind, because actually it's just darn entertaining listening to you read emails, especially with that whole audio shift thing you do, to differentiate between the text of the message and your own words.
Man, that really did turn out to be a good choice, didn't it? Super. Good. Anyway.
All right, so email it is. I was very glad to hear that you intend to stretch the current topic of discussion out over multiple episodes. I missed getting you my response before episode 24, so the fact that you're going to keep the topic going is good news. Okay. Regarding the whole "where did humanity go wrong" question, I haven't read Ishmael, but check out this odd synergy. I was listening to the last episode of Gamer the Podcasting, and Jeff mentioned meeting someone who was developing a thesis on the idea of a game master being a kind of shaman. Well, that idea is right in line with my mythic tendencies, so I went Googling to see if I could find info on that premise. I didn't find the specific thesis Jeff mentioned. What I did find was a website called The Fifth World. Here's the address to share in your notes.
And I will indeed. Folks, you've got to check this out. As far as relevant links go, it's it's pretty much a site with content that combines the open content RPG with precisely the subject we've been covering. Absolutely dead on. And with information and observations showing that this philosophical ground has been well traveled. It seems I've only just begun to consider the tip of the iceberg on this. But to continue.
This site describes a role-playing game that's in development, but it turns out the game's themes are based on real-world concepts being shared by the folks of the Anthropic Network. It's a concept that actually builds from the very same ideas you discussed in your last episode regarding Quinn's book. Here's another area of the website that contains information that's probably more pertinent to this discussion.
And he gives another link, which also, of course, will be in the Gurukatingatangatungs.
This is the manifesto that outlines Anthropic's main premise. It builds from pretty much the same foundation that you described, that humanity, most of it anyway, went wrong the moment we started large-scale agriculture. The rise of civilization actually marks the moment we got off track. The other thing that this fifth world concept concludes, though, beyond what you've already discussed, is that it postulates an inevitable and unavoidable end to civilization, a major paradigm shift that will result in humanity crawling up out of the wrecked shell of civilization we've built up around us and re-emerging as tribal permaculture societies who return to being a part of nature rather than lords over nature.
That actually is one of the main tenets of Quinn's many conclusions. His scenario does mandate the collapse of civilization for a number of reasons. Primarily that law of nature dictating that any organism that grows and consumes without limit will become extinct. But I didn't get to that last time. Anyway, to continue.
The fifth world also postulates a return to a spiritual paradigm to match the social paradigm. A return to the mythic approach to life through forms of shamanism and animism. Now, I'm not necessarily agreeing with all this myself, not whole cloth anyway. At this point, I'm new to this concept and just started to dig into it. And it would be wrong for me to either agree or disagree with it in this early in the game. But in any case, it's fascinating. And I have to admit, there are aspects of it that make a lot of sense.
I'm with you on two points here, Mick. One, I too am very early in my studies of this idea. And two, that it's fascinating. On the point of agreeing or disagreeing, it makes calm intellectual sense to get a firm grasp of the concept and a broad and a comprehensive understanding of what's being suggested with the statement that humanity began to go wrong with the rise of the agricultural or taker civilization. It makes sense to do that. But I'm going to admit that I'm not approaching this in the right way. Personally, I'm unreasonably resentful of the idea. It pisses me off. And I'm fighting it every inch of the way. This isn't helping me to understand it or think clearly about it. I'm being irrationally opposed to it at the core. But you've taken the sensible approach and want to learn more about it. I'm being dragged kicking and screaming into any kind of acceptance of it, but I can get into that later. Back to Mr. B's letter.
Beyond that, I can tell you that I myself personally believe that we went wrong when we adopted rationalism over spiritualism and fact over myth. I'm not pretending the world was an idyllic place under the mythic paradigm, because myth was used to maintain oppressive systems and perpetuate all kinds of isms. But it's not like rationalism has ended those oppressive practices. Personally, I'd rather believe in something mythic than be one of those rational, gray-suited zombie automatons who feed the machine. But that's opening a can of something for another time, perhaps. For now, that's the best I can do, touching on a big subject in a relatively little note. Look over the Fifth World stuff and see if it adds to the discussion.
Adds to the discussion. It's practically a transcription of the best we could do with this topic. Folks, wait till you see this stuff. Follow that link. Okay, conclusion of the email.
Thanks for all your wonderful specialness, Adam. I'm enthralled by your bardic eloquence. Regards, Mick.
Thank you extremely much, Mick Bradley. Yet another email of high quality and depth for IDDFOS. Now, there are a number of points in this letter that deserve closer scrutiny and exploration, but I'm going to focus on one point in particular and give it the fullest attention, and that is My Bardic Eloquence. Now, I began performing in 19... Hello?
Do I really need to say anything, you schnook?
No.
Good. Now behave yourself and do a good podcast.
Okay. Sorry. Bye.
Bye-bye, Bubble.
Bardic Eloquence. Thank you. I'll try to keep up more of that and less of some of that slow-motion plotting I was doing in the last show. And positive feedback helps. It makes me energized and determined to get a faster pace and more variety in the content. So, back to the content. Mick Bradley's letter. As he said, the site he points us to is for a role-playing game in development. And what I later discovered, and I wrote him back to tell him this, is not only does the site have to do with a role-playing game, it was developed by a group of people called the Anthropic Network, who have founded their tenets, their philosophy, their tribal revolution, I think, as they call it, and I haven't even begun to get into their stuff as far as reading what they're all about. They have a podcast, and I listened to the first of their podcasts. What was the first podcast they did? An interview with Daniel Quinn. So talk about striking pay dirt. Thank you, Mr. Bradley. Absolutely astounding. Amazing how it all ties together. It's like that novel, Oh, somebody shoot me. I can't remember the name of it. It's by Kurt Vonnegut. It's got the philosophical hero Bokonin in it. Bokoninism is talked about as a philosophy. Where he describes a device. Oh, I can't remember the name of the device either. Oh, folks, write in. Somebody tell me. Nice, nice, very nice. So many different people in the same device. A lion hunter in the jungle dark, a sleeping drunkard out in Central Park, a Chinese dentist and a British queen all fit together in the same machine. Kurt Vonnegut. What was the novel? Oh, that's terrible. I can't remember. Well, an interconnected web of events and ideas that all come together. And they certainly came together in this link. All right. Shut up, Adam. Continue. What were you going to talk about? How do we examine this? The founding premise of the game is an inevitable collapse of civilization. That civilization, in Quinn parlance, would be that of the Takers. And the rise of the survivors and remaining tribal hunter-gatherers to form a new peppering of society over the earth. Again, in Quinn terms, they would be called the Leavers. For the Judeo-Christian scholarly reference here, I would say the biblical equivalent would be the fulfillment of the prophecy, the meek shall inherit the earth. Now, let me just read off a paragraph from, just one paragraph from the Anthropic Manifesto page that Mick Bradley referenced.
The Fifth World is an open source vision of the future. It's our latest media wiki-based project. But instead of developing an encyclopedia with it, we're trying to use it to develop an anthropology of the future. Users are completely free to use, edit, and add to the wiki as they see fit, creating a uniquely realistic, changing world. The name refers to the shared belief from the Maya and the Hopi that we currently are living in the fourth world, with three preceding worlds that were destroyed by humans losing sight of their relationship with the rest of the world. In each world, there was a small group that did remember their relationship with the world, and so survived to populate the next world. On the 12th of December in 2012, according to the Mayan calendar, the fourth world, our world, will end, and the fifth world will begin. Foragers, hunter-gatherers, have a good deal more free time than we civilized folk. For the most part, this time was spent divided between three primary leisure activities: sleeping, storytelling, and gambling. The latter two are those that concern us presently. As we have already seen, the waking fantasies and communal vision of the role-playing game provides the kind of powerful, symbolic context to explore one's most intimate emotions. It is an arena rife with the potential of truly profound healing, the kind of healing so often ascribed to medicine men.
If it seems we've gotten off the topic here, folks, let me put the brakes on here and indicate that it is the tribal culture that, according to people who believe that the human being is a natural, is a part of the natural world, it's the tribal culture, the hunter-gatherer tribal structure, if you want to call it one, that lived successfully for hundreds of thousands of years without holy wars, without prophets, but rather with shaman within the tribe that would guide them spiritually. And so if this gizmo, if this civilization as a contraption that can't fly and will hit the rocks, does hit the rocks, then the supposition here is that the fifth world that will emerge from it is a return of this tribal culture, and that the role-playing game in and of itself is a reflection of the tribal behavior, or at least two aspects of the tribal behavior, storytelling and gambling, to return to what they wrote.
With its combination of two primary forager pastimes into a cooperative whole and such powerful nascent shamanistic potential, can there be any doubt that the role-playing game is the neo-tribal game par excellence?
No, I suppose there can't be. Once again, role-playing gamers, RPG enthusiasts, prove themselves ahead of their time. What to say about this? I'm going to repeat it. This subject is so dense and complex and rich. It has its own gravity well. It's just overwhelming. Focus in on one thing, Adam. Focus in on something to conclude episode 25 with. Waking fantasies and communal visions. The waking fantasies and communal visions of a hunter-gatherer tribal society that in their leisure time engages in storytelling and gambling. I'm going to go out on a limb here. Another big surprise. To some of you, what I'm about to say will fall under the category of the bleeding obvious. To some of you are going to say, oh, wow, Adam, it took you this long to figure that out? But truly, I only began reaching this conclusion when I started listening to the roundtable. When I started considering, why would these guys be so enthusiastic about myth? How to put this into a coherent, understandable concept, even for myself. Let's begin. In a civilization like the one I live in, this taker civilization, this rapid, complex civilization that's ravenous for power, both literal and figurative, a machine that seems to be revving up to a speed that will cause it to fly apart, or maybe because it's breaking the laws of nature, will hit the rocks. It seems to me that as it gets towards the end, or as it reaches its fullest power, it seems to me that there's going to be a void, an emptiness, a void in the soul of each willing or unwilling participant. A kind of an emptiness in the individual human spirit of people in this civilization, an emptiness that needs to be filled. It may just be a desire for meaning. It may be a desire to have a context for living, a context for living a vibrant, imaginative, and spiritually fulfilling life. And the taker civilization does not provide anything in it that comes close to providing such a meaning or such a context. All it provides you with, at best, is food. Now, there's within the taker civilization, there have grown up organized religions. But the messages of those organized religions in their purest form is treat all others as you'd like to be treated. Things are not as important or valuable as people. Submit to the will of God, whatever you call God, whether it's nature or the gods or the will of the earth, submit to that. You don't know better. That's the purest message there from whatever religion exists within civilization. And it's against the taker culture entirely. It's against the mechanism of civilization. More growth, more power, more consumption, more subjugation of weaker people. In fact, the Taker's civilization, as it grows enough in sophistication and complexity, it will take advantage of that emptiness I was talking about. Because one of the points that Quinn makes is that in order for the population, the people themselves within the Taker society, in order for them to function and continue, their primary occupation has to be consumption. Consume, consume, consume more. Whether it's food, furniture, Fabergé eggs, or fake vomit, just make more stuff and consume more stuff. We can't stop. So if a segment of the human population participating in the Taker race toward destruction, if that segment, in this case, for my point, I'm calling that segment the geeks. If we begin to suffer from this lack of meaning, begin to feel this void of spiritual or intellectual value for human, for being human and being alive, then that juggernaut of production and consumption will perpetuate that and will use that to sell us a new wrong thing that pretends to fill the gap. Taker civilization, in order to continue producing and growing and keep the cycle of consumption going, it has to create false needs. And through those false needs, it has to misdirect and confuse the desires, create desires among the people, and then produce every conceivable product to circulate through the consumption process that are supposed to fulfill those desires. Even if it means lying to perpetuate it. We've been hearing quaint little examples of that since I started playing vintage commercials in episode 21. And they continue right into this one, and they'll continue after it. But this is where it gets weird. This is where the Taker methodology gets weird, because through the simple law of averages, because of all the variations it has to go through, it will come up with a consumable that could kind of come close to filling that gap. The modern gap, there's two gaps we'll talk about. I mean, they're all over the human psyche. Two of the gaps we'll talk about. One is the one that the mythic heroes used to fill, and the other is the role that the tribal shaman used to fill. And in a mass market age, in our current super electronic age, some members of the population will latch onto Star Trek and Spock and Gene Roddenberry as the storyteller. Some members of the population will latch onto Firefly and Serenity and Joss Whedon as the storyteller. Some members of the segment, the geeks, are going to latch onto Lord of the Rings and Gandalf and Frodo and Tolkien as the storyteller. Or the epic flights, the epic struggles, the heroism of the comic books in the last 70 years, and all the artists and inkers and writers as the storytellers, or the supportive camaraderie of the tabletop role-playing game and the GM as the storyteller, or a combination of all those things. The meek shall inherit the earth. The meek shall inherit the earth? I'm going to confess something here. I haven't physically struck another human being since I hit Johnny Zara in the stomach when I was 8 years old. And even then, I pulled the punch, and he was a bully. I've been extremely violent on occasion toward objects, but I've never hit, punched, smacked, fought anyone, no other human being, since then. I'm a nonviolent person in day-to-day real life. And I believe I'd be correct in saying that most people who fall into the demographic that would listen to this podcast, especially up to this point, play RPGs and or read fantasy and science fiction, view the superheroes of film and television, or just have some longing for a sense of wonder that modern society has tried to extinguish for centuries. That's where that rationalism comes in that McBradley was talking about. It's tried to squash that. Most of you are the meek. Unfortunately, if the story thus far continues as humanity is writing it and as Quinn and most of his ideas see it. The Earth we'll inherit won't have Wi-Fi or antibiotics. I don't know if you have to think about this for a little bit, but I sure do, so I'm going to a break. Back in a bit.
Truth is stranger than fiction. And this is the proof. This is Ripley's. Believe it or not. The first air-conditioned house in the United States was Lime Air, built in Luray, Virginia by Colonel T.C. Northcott. It was kept cool in summer and warm in winter by air piped from the nearby Luray Caverns. Believe it or not. In a moment, I'll tell you about a weaponless duel. One of the strangest duels where no weapons were used was between two sculptors. The Great Buddha, a statue in the Diamond Mountains of Korea, was carved 600 years ago by a sculptor named Kendo. It's there because of an unusual duel in which Kendo and a rival sculptor named Rao agreed that whichever created the poorer statue would forfeit his life. Kendo won, and Rao drowned himself, believe it or not.
Hey, this is Chris McCullough and Ty McGowan from the Domain of Apocalypse.
We are a weekly role-playing podcast devoted to such topics as
RPG industry news,
a world-building exercise,
reviews of tabletop role-playing games,
computer RPG reviews,
how to get inspiration for your own role-playing games,
segments on previously played characters,
our own game updates,
and be sure to check out the forums at www.apocalypse.com.
That's www.apokolipz.com.
We'll see you there.
I don't even know where to go with this for the next episode. Consider the question as it's been asked, a standing one, and consider anything you've heard for episode 25 to be worthy of comment, response, whether you've written in or not thus far. Because I'm going to have to bring this to a close in episode 26 and hopefully come to some useful conclusions, if we can. I know I like unanswerable questions, but I do like to put some kind of closure on what we discuss. And it's going to be tough to come up with a radio, an old-time radio show that has to do with this whole topic. I imagine if I went back over my whole collection and re-listened to particularly some of the old Dimension X or science fiction episodes that had to deal with space travel or the survival of the Earth or extreme conditions like that, I could probably find something. But instead, what I have ready is a two-minute slice of a series called Jungle Jim, a hero of the Taker civilization culture involved in a struggle that appears to be unending, that of the struggle between one ideology and another. But he's aided by what we would consider, I suppose, a member of the Lever culture, the noble savage, as it were, who appears, when placed within the context of the Taker culture, who appears to have above-average capabilities. Isn't that interesting? Here's two minutes of an episode from Jungle Jim in which he has come toward the end of a fight with a terrorist trying to destroy the Panama Canal. Please enjoy this.
Thanks, Cole. Is Kitty all right?
Yes, everybody be all right, Tuan.
The canal, is it safe?
Don't talk, Tuan. You rest.
All right, Cole.
I don't guess we have to bother with Doc Beard no more, Kolu. Why, his goose is cooked.
He'd be a very bad man, Tuan.
He don't look it now. With them silly chin whiskers, he looks like a nanny go to sleep. But I guess he was a snake, all right.
He worse than snake. Snake fight you to face, not bite you in back like he shoot Jungle Jim.
He was getting ready to shoot him again while he was still on the ground.
Kolu, thank you for letting him kill Doc Beard.
Oh, don't thank me. We ain't got a man in the outfit. Why, even the sharpshooters who could have made that shot, and so fast, too. Don't you even aim?
Have to shoot fast. He was killed, Tuan Jim.
I don't want you ever taking a pot shot at me.
No, Kolu. only shoot at people like J7.
We've taken 3 prisoners, Dave.
Good man.
One of them has a broken leg. Must have gotten in the way of that torpedo when it was going down the runway. Boy, what an explosion. Must have been a ton of TNT.
Well, herd them guys over there in the corner and make sure they're tied up tight. I sent Collins back for a stretcher.
There's a stretcher in the shop closet.
Where?
Right over here.
Well, what are you waiting for? Hurry up and get it. The quicker we can get him back to the base, the happier I'll be.
I think he hurt bad. That be only time Jim stay lying down.
Nah, he ain't hurt so bad. Our doc can fix him up.
Here you are, Dave.
Ah, here. All right. Lay it right down here.
Yeah.
Now, you, Collins, you with the head. Mm-hmm. Here, Jack, the feet, and I'll take the middle. All right, let's get him on it.
Come on. There we are.
Easy, oh. Cousin. There you are. Now then, fellas, all together. Up. And stay in step.
Twan, Jim, you be all right now.
Yeah. Thanks, Colo. Thanks for everything.
That episode in its entirety, and it's only 15 minutes long, will be available for download with my compliments and hopes that you'll give it a try and enjoy it. Jungle Jim, part of our old-time radio heritage and a product of that awful, evil, prideful, who-do-we-think-we-are taker civilization headed towards ultimate destruction. Well, maybe we are. I don't know. Well, I'm both very, very happy and a little bit disappointed that I've run so far overtime on this show. At least I'm getting the impression that I will. I'm hoping this won't reach another hour and a half episode, but because that's a bit much for most people to have to deal with, even me. But I gotta wind it down here now. And I suppose if there's going to be any kind of a concentration of this subject into wrapping it up for a third episode, because I know we haven't even scratched the surface on just what could have been dealt with in this episode in terms of the question of leavers and takers. I guess the question would have to be for next week, what else were we supposed to do? Just as I ranted to Ishmael the gorilla over, if we weren't to develop civilization, if we weren't to develop large-scale food production, agriculture, and civilization, what else? Well, what was the alternative? What natural line would we have followed? Where would we be right now? And I suppose the other half of that question would be, since we didn't, where best can we go from here? I'm not even going to start talking about it, but I'm just going to bring the episode to a close. I'm going to play this piece of music now. It's a very obscure piece of music that's 20 years old, and if you can identify it for me, I'd be overjoyed. I really, really doubt you can. It's 4 minutes long. It's very beautiful. It's a Celtic, nautical-sounding violin piece. Very modern, actually. And I'll tell you all about it in the next episode, because I just don't want to take up more of your time talking about music that I could be playing. And so, please listen to this. Thank you. Always enjoyed that piece. So we reach the end of episode 25, part 2 of 3, dealing with humanity and our role in nature and on Earth. I'd like to thank once again Derek, Sarah, Camera Guy, Mick Bradley, anyone else that's ever written to the show. I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode. I hope you'll be back for episode 26. And whether Kurt is listening to episode 26 or not, I will be explaining why the podcast is called International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. And until then, I hope everything goes well for you. But again, until then, best of days.
A thought. Remember, listen for another adventure of
International Detective Dragons from Outer Space.